Series of Senate occasional lectures. We've solved our technical difficulties here and we're ready to press on with a very interesting lecture on the issue of gender and politics. It does raise very interesting and complex questions, and you might recall that in 2006 cross-party coalitions of women senators promoted and shepherded through the Parliament two very important private senators' bills on quite controversial matters that made it into law. And at the time, questions were asked, is this a new paradigm in Australian politics? Well, I think that the question's not answered yet, but it's one that we continue to ask. But today, to throw light on the situation in Europe and also to raise some general questions, it's my very great pleasure to introduce Professor Yvonne Galligan. She's from Queen's University in Belfast and is currently enjoying a fellowship with the Australian National University. So to talk to us about gender and democracy, please welcome Professor Yvonne Galligan.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Lang, and thank you for the to speak in the Australian Senate Occasional Lecture Series. It's a great honour and privilege to address you today on a subject that is very dear to my heart, which is gender and democracy. And I will be putting it in a European context because that's probably the context I know best, but I would like to try and draw some parallels with Australia in the course of what I say. And also I hope that as I speak about a particular European case and draw lessons from it, those lessons will also be apparent that they are applicable in an Australian context and in any context in which democratic politics takes place and where gender equality is an issue that is debated in parliaments and in assemblies elsewhere. So I would like to begin by showing you in my first slide. Next, I go to next. Every mouse is a little bit different, so it takes a little while to get used to what you have to do. So this is an outline of my talk. It will come in three parts. First of all, I will set a context. Secondly, I will move to a particular case, a particular law, or in European terms, a directive, which is a binding law on the member states of the European Union, of which, by the way, there are 27 member states. And the law I look at is the Goods and Services Directive, which I will go into in some more detail at that point. And then I will go to the third part of my talk, which is reflecting on what the story of the Goods and Services Directive tells us about gender and democracy in a wider context and in the European context as a whole. So, to move to the next point, I want to ask, what do we mean when we put the words gender and democracy together? What does that imply? Well, it highlights one of the fundamental principles on which democracy is based, that of political equality. It highlights a second issue as well, that of popular control. And I will be returning to these two fundamental principles of democracy, political equality and popular control, at the end of my talk. But turning to equality at the moment, this notion of equality is not confined to voting rights alone. The notion of equality and political equality in gender terms is much more substantive than just the right to vote and the equal right to vote. Indeed, putting the word gender alongside the word democracy casts a light on democracy in action. And it draws attention to the extent to which women and women's representatives are included in policy making. It highlights the occasions when women's and men's life patterns and interests diverge, and it draws attention to the manner in which a political system chooses to tackle the inequalities that one observes arising from that. So the study of politics, in one way or another, places a spotlight on democracy and its performance, particularly its performance in terms of gender. The questions asked in various democratic audits around the world, and there has been a democratic audit of Australia, ask how well is democracy working and what can be done to enhance and improve this form of public decision making. In a paper for the Democratic Audit of Australia in 2007, entitled Democratic Principles, Political Equality, Professor Marion Soar succinctly discusses Australian democracy with respect to this principle of democratic equality. In my work, along with colleagues in Northern Ireland and other European countries and regions, I bring the gender question to bear in assessing the quality of democracy by asking how democratic from a gender point of view is the political life of a region, a country, or a transnational body, and how well are the rights of women protected and enhanced and advanced in these contexts. I use the case of the European Union because this is a transnational political entity with an explicit commitment in principle and in practice to gender equality. At its founding in 1957, the European Economic Community provided for equal pay between men and women for equal work. The principle of equal pay was finally given legal form or law in 1974. And since then, a further 9 directives or laws, which are, as I said, binding on member states, have been enacted in the field of employment and social protection. These cover the equal treatment of men and women in social security, in self-employment, the protection of pregnant workers, and parental leave, a hot topic in Australian politics at the moment. Indeed, some of these issues have continued to remain on the agenda and have continued to be elaborated through the European Court of Justice findings. An additional directive was introduced in 2004, covering women's and men's equal access to goods and services available to the public, such as housing and accommodation, banking, insurance, and transport. I will discuss this law in more detail in a moment. Other measures too support the principle of gender equality in the European Union. Positive action in the form of preferential treatment is permitted to redress gender inequalities. Gender mainstreaming is a policy instrument that is used to incorporate the different situations and perspectives of women and men into all stages of policy making. Multi-annual equal opportunities programmes have given focus and direction to the principled commitments to gender equality that is found in successive EU treaties. And as well, as I have mentioned before, the European Court of Justice has played a significant role in interpreting the gender equality provisions of EU treaties and in enabling individuals to enforce their right to gender equality through taking legal cases that end up in the European Court of Justice. In short, the commitment to gender equality has been visible and progressive over 5 decades of the Union, bringing tangible improvements to the working lives of women across the now 27 member states. Now, I'd like to pause here for a moment and look at the situations of women and men in the EU and Australia, because what struck me when I was looking at this point is, in fact, how similar they are. And you can see from some of these very quick statistics that I gathered together that there are many similarities between the European Union as a whole and Australia. The gender pay gap, the one at the bottom, is very similar. Sorry, some of you are not able to see. Okay. The gender pay gap is very similar, 18% in across the European Union, 17% in Australia, which is still very persistent, I would argue, in both places. Very difficult to narrow that gender pay gap. The life expectancy, I have to say, Australia comes out on top for women and men in that regard. It has to be the good weather, the easy lifestyle, and generally the excellent healthcare system that is benefiting Australian citizens. I think in Europe we've a lot to learn from you. In terms of third level education, which is often a marker of how well a country is doing in terms of equality between women and men, we find very similar, very similar patterns where women are equal or a little bit more involved in third level education. That does hide a lot of imbalances in terms of the sectors of education. For example, women's participation in engineering and the hard sciences in both places is much lower than it is, let's say, in the medical professions, in the biomedical and industries and biotechnology industries and other arts and humanities and social sciences. But nonetheless, women's and men's participation at third level education is very similar. Women's and men's participation in the workforce is very similar. As you can see, those workforce rates are very applicable. So there's a lot that is very similar in both our sets of jurisdictions. But in terms of the EU, and getting back to the EU in that regard, the impressive record on supporting and advancing gender equity leads many of my colleagues from other parts of the world to what one of them has called EU envy. They can only dream of a regional transnational standardising authority with real clout that could, for instance, address the parental leave debate currently at issue in Australia in a woman-friendly way, or tackle sexual harassment of the workplace, or other employment and occupational discrimination issues that arise in all our countries in one shape or form. But I want now to turn to my story today, which tries to highlight really to what extent is the European Union open to really practicing what it preaches. So this strong, principle-based and action-focused commitment to gender equality is nonetheless subject to stresses, to bargaining, and to limits. And this is where I want to go in my talk. I want to show, through one instance of gender equality policy making, that even the EU's commitment to gender equity is contingent when powerful economic interests come to play. And through an exploration of these limits, I hope to be able to say something about the relationship between gender and democracy more generally. The questions that I will pose are, What does this story tell us about the EU's democratic decision-making processes when it comes to gender equality? What aspects of the gender equality agenda end up being included, and what pieces go by the wayside? To what extent can gender equality be at the core of the deliberations by the three key decision-making forums, the Parliament, the Commission, and the Council? And what lessons can we learn from this story that can illuminate our understanding of gender in practice in democracies? Now, this is a relatively new set of questions in EU research that treats the European Union as a democratic entity in its own right, rather than as a regime that regulates the policies of its member states, as some see it, or as a forum for intergovernmental bargaining and negotiation that others see it. Certainly, there are elements of regulation and intergovernmentalism present in all EU affairs. But neither of these concepts conveys the full picture of European transnational decision-making. So against this backdrop, I want to take a closer look at the enactment of the Goods and Services Directive passed by the European Council in 2004. So, this is the story. In June 2000, the European Commission made it known for the first time that it was going to draft legislation on gender equality for areas other than employment. And this is quite significant, because up until then, the European Union had put in place a very extensive body of legislation, as I've just outlined, but all related to employment and employment-related matters. This was the first time for gender equality questions that it was stepping outside that framework. And it was an important moment as well, because at that point in time, the European Council, which is basically composed of representatives of all the governments of the European member states, had at that time assented to a race equality directive, which banned discrimination on racial grounds in employment and outside employment as well. It was a short step then from this law to a plan that would extend gender equality to areas not already covered by employment-related laws. The European Council gave approval for this directive or law in December 2000. And at that point, it was fairly clear that the Commission, which is responsible for drafting all European legislation, intended to bring education and other goods and services into the new gender equality law to make it similar to the race equality law. Now, the Council's approval and giving the go-ahead for this law mobilised women's civil society organisations and EU official advisory bodies on gender equality to make their views known as to what the new law should contain. So the European Women Lawyers Association and the European Women's Lobby began to develop positions on this new directive. The European Women Lawyers Association, which is basically, from its name, you can tell that it is an expert group drawn from all countries in the European Union of women lawyers committed to pushing gender equality questions. They wanted a broad, proactive law covering all aspects of life that are outside of employment. They wanted it to be illegal, for example, for landlords to refuse to take families with young children as tenants. They wanted it to be illegal for airlines to refuse to take pregnant women as passengers. And they wanted it also to outlaw and to ban the practice of some banks refusing loans to businesswomen when they had young children. So these kinds of discriminations against women were taking place across the European Union, and the European women lawyers wanted those ruled out. They also wanted a ban on sex discriminatory advertising, and they wanted a general requirement for positive action in all fields. The European Women's Lobby consulted with its members, and the European Women's Lobby, again, is a civil society organisation. It's a non-governmental organisation, an NGO, and it has members in each of the member states of the European Union that basically taps into the organised women's movement in all the member states. And the European Women's Lobby in Brussels consulted widely with its members in all its member states, and it sought to have 10 areas of life included in the new law, including that there would be gender equality in decision making. Obviously, access and supply of goods and services would be included, and violence against women they wanted to have included under this law. They also wanted issues of taxation included. While drafting its proposals, the European Women's Lobby cooperated very closely with some of the institutions of the European Union that need to be consulted in terms of laws, such as the Advisory Committee on Equal Opportunities Between Women and Men. This advisory committee, its position when it advised the Commission on the gender equality law, took a line that was very much in keeping with that of the European Women's Lobby. So over a period of time, a consensus was created between women's civic organisations and women's expert groups around the content of this law. And they communicated those views to the Commission. The Commission then circulated an unofficial draft suggesting that only some of these issues be taken on board. So the Commission suggested that instead of taking all the requests of the women's and women's supporting groups on board, that they would draft a law that included equal access to goods and services for women and men, and they included education, taxation, advertising, and the media in that regard. Now, the Commission proposal bore a lot of parallel to the European Women Lawyers Association submission, but it also had an overlap with some of the issues that other women's organisations wanted raised. However, this early draft was very much disagreed with by the media industry and the insurance industry. Media representatives launched a hostile campaign in which they argued that the proposed law, and particularly its intention to ban gender stereotypes in media and advertising, represented what they called, and I quote, an extraordinary move towards censorship, which would clash, in their view, with the principle of freedom of expression. This campaign involved attacks in the media directed against the Commissioner for Employment and Social Affairs, who happened to be a woman, Anna Diamantopoulou, a Greek woman, and some of the more moderate articles that were published around that time had titles such as Big Sister is Watching You, or Feminist Eurocrat Who Wants to Ban Sexist, in inverted commas, TV shows and advertisements. So similarly, the insurance industry argued that the proposal to eliminate sex differences as a factor in calculating insurance premiums and benefits would have very serious repercussions for consumers, since it would require the insurance industry to raise their prices in order to protect their profits. In addition to the objectives of these objections of these interest groups, some member states, as well as a number of commissioners, also expressed their opposition to this proposal. So something that started out as an effort to extend gender equality beyond the field of employment became a very hot potato indeed. When it seemed that the process would not advance due to the strong polarisation between the groups involved, the women's organisations continued to lobby for a directive or a law that at least provided for equal treatment in insurance premiums, equal treatment of women and men in education, the advertising and the media, as well as taxation. And MEPs from different groups signed a declaration of solidarity with Commissioner Diamantopoulou, stating that the sexist attacks against her, again I quote, put into great danger the adoption of a new proposal for a directive aiming to eliminate sex discrimination. Despite the pressure by all parts of the women's sector for a broad directive, the proposal that finally came out by the Commission provided for equal access to and supply of goods and services pretty much only. Now, it did prohibit various discriminations. So pregnant women and issues around maternity were prohibited as discrimination grounds. Harassment and sexual harassment in the supply of goods and services was prohibited. And there was a positive action provision as well. So it went some way to meeting the proposal of the European Women's Lawyers, and to some extent accommodated the demands of the insurance industry. The proposal was also enacted under a particular heading, or a particular, procedure, that meant that the European Parliament was not on an equal basis with the European Council in terms of making the decision. The European Parliament in this instance could only give advice to the European Commission, to the European Council, as to what decision it could make. The narrow scope of the proposal was criticised widely. It was criticised, obviously, by the women's groups. It was also criticised by various institutions within the European framework of institutions in general, such as the Committee of the Regions. It criticised the scope of the proposal, and the Economic and Social Committee also regretted the exclusion of education from the scope of the directive. The European Parliament sought to strike a middle ground between what the Commission was trying to advance and what other groups and institutions with an equality-seeking view wanted to see enacted. And it passed in its debate on the issue. It passed 34 amendments when the issue was debated in Parliament. And it is one of the few issues in the European Parliament where there was cross-party agreement. And it's very interesting to hear that there was cross-party agreement in the Australian case in terms of implementing and introducing passing gender laws in the Australian Parliament. This was an example in the European Parliament of women from across all the party families, the Socialist, the European People's Party, which is broadly Christian Democratic, the Green Party and other groups, the Liberals, all basically coming to a consensus on the gender equality propositions in this particular piece of legislation. However, despite this broad consensus across the political divide in the European Parliament, the Commission representative would not accept any of the substantive amendments tabled by the European Parliament. And when the draft law came to the Council for deliberation, it needed unanimity among the 27 member state representatives to pass. Now, in Council, it was subject to some particular disagreement. Seven of the 25 member states disagreed with the narrow scope of the draft law. So that suggests that seven of those member states were aware of the concerns of gender equality advocates. And for the record, those countries or representatives of those countries were Belgium, Finland, Luxembourg, Malta, the Netherlands, Portugal and Sweden. So they actually specifically said that they were unhappy with the narrow nature of this particular law. But their concerns were outweighed by a much deeper rift. And again, they had positions on that deeper rift. And the deeper rift was, on the one hand, there was concern that with the potential discrimination against women in terms of insurance contributions, that women would be discriminated against precisely because they happen to be women in terms of insurance, pensions, health, other kinds of insurance contributions. And this was also the view of the Commission. So the issue of non-discrimination was a principled issue in that regard. The other countries, on the other side, or other countries, argued that the potential costs of introducing a gender equal provision in insurance terms would harm the insurance industry and would be bad for consumers. So basically, very much in agreement with the insurance industry's position. Now, this took some time to resolve, because in order for the law to be passed, unless it were to fall completely, it had to be passed unanimously, not by a majority vote. The disagreement was resolved with the decision that, in principle, the use of sex as a factor in the calculation of premiums and benefits should not result in differences to individual premiums and benefits, but exceptions could be allowed. So you can see that it was, to some extent, the classical political solution to a political problem. Germany did not accept this arrangement, but Germany decided to abstain from the vote in order to avoid blocking the directive, because this was the position that went some way in terms of the principle and also some way in terms of the concerns regards cost. The directive was finally adopted on the 13th of December 2004. Now, as a codicil to this, the directive is now in place across Europe and in the member states. A recent assessment of its implementation indicates that most countries have amended legislation that's already on the statute books to take into account the provisions of the Goods and Services Directive. 12 countries have gone further, in fact, and have seen this directive as basically a floor in terms of equal rights in certain areas rather than a ceiling. And they have provided for non-discrimination in education on gender grounds. 6 have banned discrimination in media and advertising. So some of the countries have adopted some of the issues that were being debated and were being sought for by the women and equality advocates at the European level. Others have not. The sorts of issues being highlighted by the working out and the application of this directive include, for example, the controversial questions around the controversial practice of advertising children-free spa hotels in Estonia. Because under the Goods and Services Directive, these hotels should be open to women and to men. And if they're children free, well, then it's obviously very difficult for families to go on holiday to these spa hotels in Estonia. In Romania, it has been raised in terms of hospitals, where hospitals that practice have not allowed fathers to stay with their hospitalised children. And that has been questioned under this particular law in Romania, providing equal access to fathers to their children while they are in a hospital in Romania. And in Austria, the free entry to nightclubs for women, but not for men, has been a subject that has been raised in Austria and has been found to be discriminatory and coming in under the this particular directive in Austria. But in a controversial case involving a male-only exclusive golf club in Ireland, taken under the national provisions of the Goods and Services Law, the Irish High Court ruled that, and I quote, "There is nothing inherently undesirable with persons seeking, in a social context, the society of persons of the same gender." So in dear old Ireland, it's going to be some time before the application of the Goods and Services Directive is really going to fully take place in Ireland. And it would not surprise me if that particular finding were appealed to the European Court of Justice, because that's the natural progression for it, route for it to go. So what does this tell us about gender and democracy? And I'm here coming to the final part of what I want to say. First, it tells us that powerful sectional economic interests can sway policymakers more readily than a stated commitment to ensuring equality between women and men. Well, this is not new, nor is it specific to the European Union indeed. But it is a stark reminder that the democratic process is one of contestation, and there is often very little counterweight to the power of vested insiders. In this case, the insiders were the insurance and the media industries. Democrats should be concerned about this imbalance, and particularly so when it directly affects one half of the population. The principle of political equality is clearly compromised in this case. Second, it tells us that women's representatives, civic and institutional, took an active part in developing ideas as to what this particular proposed law should contain, but their efforts had very much a hit and miss level of success. The proposals of the European Parliament were not taken on board, nor were those, by and large, of the various committees and consultative bodies of the European Union. Although the voice of Parliament in this instance, was procedurally restricted in the passage of this law, it was still open to the Council to consider the views of the European Parliament informally. This points to the limits of EU democratic decision-making in this particular case. It also illustrates the limits of influence by women's advocates, be they group or institutional, at EU level. There are issues of communication and accountability here. The question also is, to what extent did members of the European Parliament that supported this directive in the European Parliament raise it in their national contexts, either with their parliamentary representatives or women's NGOs or both? The fact that some countries went beyond the EU law in their national implementation suggests that there was a post hoc national awareness of these issues and a commitment by some governments to extend the directive. It is somewhat of a pity that that awareness was not present during forcefully stated during the debates at the Council level. On a more general point, though, what it does point out is the distance between what happens at European level and the concerns of national politics, and that's emblematic of the democratic deficit that representative elites in Europe, be they elected or civil society elites, need to answer for. The third point in relation to democracy in this case is that it makes the recognition of gender equality a contingent matter. It tells us that even with the extensively stated EU commitment to supporting equality between women and men, recognition of this equality in practice continues to be a struggle, a site of contestation. Although in this case, the principle of non-discrimination and equal treatment of women and men was upheld, it was compromised by the narrow remit of the law and the exceptions afforded to the insurance industry. In conclusion, and to return to my starting point, if gender is to form an integral part of democratic politics, this case suggests three things. First, that the positions of gender and equality seeking representatives must be included, they must be accorded equal weight, and they must be around the negotiating table. The second is that all representatives, be they elected or not directly elected in one shape or form, once they are representatives, they must be accountable for their positions to those whom they represent. And the decision-making processes must be sufficiently open and transparent to enable those whom they represent to hold them accountable for the positions that they hold. In other words, accountability goes hand in hand with popular control of government at whatever level this may be, and membership control of their organisations. The third thing it tells us is that a recognition of women's legitimate claims to equality with men should infuse the democratic decision-making process. And when we take that on board, it means that we need to recognise difference as well as sameness. And we need to recognise that women's life interests and practices and patterns need to be addressed in a way that respects those life patterns and enhances gender equality for all, so that the principle of political equality and the principle of popular control can be given effect in gender terms. So I would like to thank you for listening to my talk today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Galligan. That was a very interesting insight into very important issues. As is customary at these occasions, Professor Galligan's very happy to take questions. So if you have a question or perhaps a short comment, I invite you to come to the microphone.
Legislation, but the EU does focus on human rights discourse to the extent that it says that Turkey isn't yet ready for admission and so on. It's one of the benchmarks by which some of the member states are assessed for for entry to the Union. So would you comment on the role of the treaty and the global framework in this context, please?
Do you want me to? Yeah, okay. Well, you raise a very, very big question there. And one of the reasons why I didn't specifically focus on sex discrimination is because in terms of internal EU politics, there are the question of sex discrimination, particularly in employment and employment-related matters, is very well, provided for in a whole range of laws and policies. But the wider question, the implementation of CEDAW, and agreement around the Turkey question are huge, huge issues. Certainly, I think that the European Union would have particular positions in terms of the enactment of CEDAW that would be very, very supportive of the CEDAW provisions and CEDAW treaty and protocol. And the European Union itself, in terms of its own treaties, sees gender equality as a fundamental value of the European Union and also a specific requirement of the European Union to eliminate gender inequalities. Now, when the question comes to the access of Turkey to the European Union, there are many dimensions to be brought to bear on that in terms of human rights. I think that certainly in terms of the EU's relationship with Turkey, that it has had an impact internally in terms of Turkey's own legislation on human rights. Certainly Turkey feels a pressure from the European Union to implement human rights legislation. There are a lot of very sensitive questions around religion and politics that come to bear. These are big questions that member states need to address. The Irish president, not so long ago, stated that she hoped that Turkey would find its way into the European Union, but it is still a long way off, I think. Certainly in terms of the larger states of France and Germany, who have particular views in that regard. So I'm not sure exactly how you want me to kind of infuse all of that, But there are influences that are taking place between Europe on human rights legislation in Turkey. And there certainly is a dialogue taking place, and there are influences in that regard. It's going to go for a long time to come, though. It's not a story with an ending very soon in sight.
Do we have another question? Yes, would you like to come to the microphone?
I think I'll be okay from here.
Yes, and that's a very interesting point because, in fact, the Women's Coalition as a political party, in fact, owes a great deal to the connections that the women's movement in Northern Ireland maintained with Europe all during the period of the Troubles. And one of the strong elements of women and politics in Northern Ireland has been how to keep connected, again, in terms of, as our earlier speaker said, human rights, how to keep connected with these kinds of questions without being totally absorbed and totally sucked in by the conflict over the constitutional question. So, in fact, Europe and the United Nations provided during the period of the Troubles an arena for women involved in politics and concerned with democracy and democratic questions to maintain some kind of a different perspective on what was happening within Northern Ireland society. And it's no accident that the Women's Coalition arose not just from a feminist movement, but from being informed by the debates that were happening in the European arena and in the wider international arena. And because of that, because they were able to bring a different perspective, a different way of speaking about the problem of the conflict to bear on the question. When the point came of negotiating a peace, then there was space for their voice. Now, mind you, they had to struggle to have that recognised, but nonetheless it was recognised and it was seen as being an important new and different perspective to bring to bear that the parties that centred their politics around the conflict and around resolving the conflict were not bringing to bear. And I think it's very indicative that George Mitchell, in his autobiography, says that the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 could not have come about if the Women's Coalition had not been present to be the facilitator of that agreement, which is really very interesting. So George Mitchell put great store in the way the Women's Coalition was able to speak to all sides and was not trapped and was not captured by any side. And so that was its unique contribution. And then it further went in on in terms of the assembly to develop a distinctive voice on politics in Northern Ireland. Sadly, the politics of the conflict kind of caught them as a middle ground party and caught others and kind of squeezed the centre, so they were squeezed out of politics. But nonetheless, the Northern Ireland Women's Coalition played a very important role at a very critical point in time, precisely because they were able to look at the question through a different discourse and through a different set of eyes.
I think we've got time for one more.
Thank you. I wanted to briefly raise two areas where I had difficulty understanding the rationale for what you were saying. The one concerned your apparent criticism of resorts which were not child-friendly, and I didn't understand why this constituted discrimination on the basis of sex or gender. Children have parents of both genders. And indeed, it seems to me that there's a good social case for having resorts which don't have children, because a lot of older people would prefer to go to a holiday resort that, in fact, doesn't have lots of screaming children. So it's a recognition of the interests of older people as well as the interests of younger people. But perhaps the deeper question concerns insurance. I assume that the criticism of the insurance industry was based on a perception that the costs of insuring men and women are different. Now, if the costs are different, what is the rationale for requiring companies to charge the same to customers where the costs, in fact, are different? That's something that I think you didn't explain. You assumed that it must be the case. But can you explain the rationale?
Okay, well, the children-free hotels in Estonia. In a way, the question, there is something deeper going on there than just the issue of people being entitled to a quiet retreat. The question there is to some extent based around, let's say, resorts that are used for the male entertainment issue. So it's really about questions around, these spa, child-free spas are really, really feed into the trafficking of women for prostitution purposes. And that's really what's going on in the Estonia case, rather than people of different ages looking for different things in terms of their recreational lives. So it's not just a simple family-friendly or non-family-friendly question. The question around insurance, and again, I didn't go into a huge detail because I wanted to give a bigger picture story there. What the Commission and others were trying to ensure was that women were not being discriminated against on grounds of pregnancy, on grounds of maternity, on grounds that related to them, to their lives as women. So that if women were in insurance schemes and if men were in insurance schemes, the issue of maternity and pregnancy would not be a loading factor for women. Now, the issue of the fact that women live longer than men and that loads women's insurance is in fact permitted. That is allowed because that is an objectively justified risk factor. But other factors, such as being a mother of young children, is not an objectively justifiable reason for loading women's, let's say, pension insurance or life contributions or whatever else it is. So it, there were those kinds of issues that were coming out and coming to bear.
Well, Professor Gallagher, we've reached the end of our allotted hour. May I say it's been an absolute delight to listen to you and your beautiful accent, but thank you also for a very stimulating lecture, and I ask you to join with me in thanking Professor Gallagher.